From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 16th day of November 2017. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker. He's at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. I'll remind you to pick up your tickets for the Farm Assets Conference. That's next Tuesday in Normal, Illinois. The cost is $35. Tickets available online. WillAg.org, FarmAssetsConference.com, 800-898-1065 if you just want to dial in. We'll also talk today with a senior economics analyst from the Environmental Working Group. They've written some not-so-nice things about the ARC and PLC programs. We'll find out why. And then as we close out our time together, we'll discuss the weather forecast with Mike Tenora at T-Storm Weather out of Chicago, right here on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. We're now joined by Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas, to take a look at what happened in Chicago. Hey, Dan, thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be with you, Todd.
It seems like there's not an awful lot to talk about in the marketplace today, though it's kind of heavy.
Yeah, when you get into a big crop year like we have, harvest drags on. We're not quite there. We're almost there, but we still have some harvest activity going on. So you still have a little harvest pressure coming into the marketplace. And many times when we have a big crop like we've got this year, the markets will have a tendency to drift right on into the end of the month, first part of December. And that would be a key time frame for the markets to maybe find some stabilization. I still think the lead futures corn market is still kind of a 340, 360 type trading range. But what we have here is December futures is slipping down underneath that as a week from now, we're going to be basically the functioning lead futures contract as you go into December deliveries is going to be the March. So the March, I think, is going to kind of take over where the December futures have been trading through most of the fall, which is in this, 340 to 355 range. Soybeans, we did lose some today, but we didn't lose everything that we gained yesterday. So soybeans do look like they're trying to stabilize. Harvest is further along, pretty well wrapped up in most areas there. Wheat futures, while they were lower or unchanged, we still look like it's trying to find some stability. So I think it's just a matter of time that, this December corn futures, as we go into the delivery or the expiration period, we're seeing some weakness as it, begins to go off the board, Todd.
And then will we see, you think, a seasonal upturn as we end the year or not?
Many times you do. But I think this crop year has been such a, if USDA's numbers are right that they gave us here a week or two ago, it tells me that we probably have a lot of inventory unpriced from the farmer. And probably what he's going to end up doing is use basis contracts or maybe sell some more, depending upon what their cash flow situation is as they go in toward the end of the year. So we'll probably still see year-end movement, but it may be more so through a basis contract or something like that. So we may not necessarily see downward hedge pressure, but December is really a hard month to get a rally going unless you have something going on in South America and or you have a short crop here in the United States. And since we have a large crop, a super large crop, and right at the moment talking to the weather guys, for South America, they don't really see any big problems, at least for the next couple of weeks, but that doesn't mean something won't begin to change. I always look for weather patterns to change around the first day of spring, first day of fall, the first day of winter. So as we get into that December 21st time frame period, that might be a time frame period that weather problems could begin to start creeping into the picture for South America, but we just don't know yet.
Hey, thanks for taking the time with us today. We'll not talk with you next week because that'll be Thanksgiving. So we'll talk with you in 2 weeks, and maybe things will have changed by then.
Well, let's hope so.
For the better. All right. Hey, thanks much, Dan.
Okay, Todd.
That, of course, is Dan Zwicker. He's with Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media for this Thursday afternoon. I hope you picked up your tickets for the Farm Assets Conference. That's Tuesday in Normal, Illinois. If not, you can still do that right now for $35 at WILLAG.org, Farm Assets Conference, or you can just call this number, 800-898-1065. So WILLAG.org, farmassetsconference.com, or 800-898-1065. We'll kick off the day's events by having a discussion about the Farm Bill. I'll probably take up trade as well. I would suspect we'll also look into crop insurance, which is part of the Farm Bill, but in a different place than some of the Title I programming and other ag legislation, maybe infrastructure. So it'll be a good day there. I thought maybe it might be important to discuss some of that with some outside coalitions before we get started so that you'll have some basis for where that Farm Bill discussion may go and already is involved. Washington, D.C. Ann Weir Schechinger is here. She's a senior economics analyst at the Environmental Working Group on Tuesday of this week. And today, in fact, they released a couple of news items called Double Dipping. These were how they were titled, How Taxpayers Subsidize Farmers Twice for Their Crop Losses. We had that in our newscast on Tuesday, and Ann is one of the authors of this article. Ann, thanks so much for being here today. I appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
So Ann works with the Environmental Working Group. For those of you who have been around for a very long time, you will recognize the name of this group. And probably one of the things you'll remember is that some years ago they created a database of farmers, landowners in particular, and the government payments or subsidies that are put out to each of those. So I should make note here that because I am now a landowner after my father passed away, you can find my name in that database, though I haven't looked it up. This is something that actually I think farmers use from time to time, although it wasn't really very well received, Ann, when it was put out. So now I want to know where it is and what it is that the Environmental Working Group is talking about this time as we go into the Farm Bill discussions happening in Washington, D.C., as related to Title I and crop insurance and the ARC program, particularly here, but ARC and PLC, which are in the Title I numbers.
So our new report that we released on Tuesday talks about these Title I and crop insurance programs. So the report describes two new farm subsidy programs that were created in the 2014 Farm Bill to replace the old direct payments program, which I'm sure a lot of people will remember. The Agricultural Risk Coverage Program, or ARC, pays farmers when county revenues fall below an expected amount, while the Price Loss Coverage Program, or PLC, pays out when crop prices decrease below a certain level set by Congress. So the main point of our report is that these ARC and PLC programs are essentially paying farmers for the same reasons as the federal crop insurance program, because crop insurance pays farmers when their revenues fall below a predicted level. So this double dipping, where the same farmers in the same counties receive payments from multiple programs, costs American taxpayers almost $23.9 billion for the 2014 and 2015 growing seasons. And $13.2 billion of this came from ARC and PLC, while the other $10.7 billion was from revenue crop insurance policies.
Yeah, so the point of the article, I think, was that EWG suggests that they're being paid for the same thing twice. I'm wondering what your understanding of how these programs work might be and why they were put into place. So let's start with ARC and PLC and what EWG believes the programs are supposed to do.
So ARC and PLC were put in place to replace direct payments. And they're kind of what you consider a shallow loss program. So they're not for huge losses. It's for a loss in price with regards to both programs, or a loss in yield with regards to the ARC program. So the ARC is a revenue program. So when a county level revenue falls below a certain expected amount, then all the farmers in that county for that crop get a payment. And for price loss coverage, when the price of the crop falls below a reference price set by Congress, then all of the farmers in that county receive a payment.
So these programs were set up, and you can tell me whether you believe this is correct or not, in order to smooth out the transition from very high price years to very low price years, or just over time, so that farmers who might be subject from one year to the next to large, and maybe over a longer period of time, in fact, large transitions from very high revenues to very low revenues. And it's something of a way, I think, for them to make that transition easier. Is that a general explanation you would think is correct?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and then for the crop insurance, these are in-season or single-year mm-hmm. payments that producers put money into, and so do the taxpayers, in fact.
Yep, so crop insurance is an annual program, and farmers pay some money into the program for premiums, but 62% on average of the crop insurance premiums are subsidized by taxpayers. And then when a farmer has a loss, such as in crop price or crop yield, then they receive a payment based on their crop insurance policy. And the majority of crop insurance policies are for revenue. So you, again, get paid based on if your revenue at the end of the season is smaller than what you expected.
So these are insurance products, and the intent, and they're unlike insurance products that most people would be familiar with, on the idea that the producer over a long period of time, say 10 or 12 years, is likely to get all of the premium back that he paid over the insurance, the lifetime of the insurance. And they're supposed to check in-season problems with a crop that might be localized, while the ARC and PLC programs are statewide or much more regional. The crop insurance programs are to protect local problems that might exist from a low crop yield for whatever reason that might come, usually because of drought, but for other reasons as well. So is that a good explanation of how the crop insurance program is supposed to function and the reasons it was put in place?
Yeah, crop insurance is an individual policy. So each farmer or farm can have a policy, whereas the ARC and PLC are on a larger basis.
So while the farmers truly do have two programs that they might be working with, how do you find that they're double dipping in the process?
So the double dipping comes from this idea of a reduction in price. So the way that crop insurance works, if the price is higher in the beginning of the season than it is at harvest, you still get paid through crop insurance at that higher price that happened at the beginning of the season.
That, of course, is called the harvest price option. Is this the part of the crop insurance program that EWG is it would like not to be around in the future?
I think it's something to think about, but our main focus for now is on the ARC and PLC programs.
Why would that be the case?
So our main focus is on really targeting farm subsidies to the people who need them. You know, the majority of farm subsidy recipients, well, most farm subsidy payments go to the largest and most successful farmers. So we really want to focus on targeting these payments to the smaller farmers that are really struggling or really need the money. And so we kind of see with ARC and PLC, because of our farm subsidy database, where we get to see actual recipient names of who's receiving ARC and PLC payments, we see that those are majorly going to the most successful farms. So that's kind of more our target in this farm bill fight.
That's Ann Weir Schickinger. She's a senior economics analyst for the Environmental Working Group. I spoke with her earlier in the day. At this point in our conversation, things broke down essentially because neither of us could come to any conclusion as to the size of the target farmer for the Environmental Working Group as it relates to ARC and PLC payments. They used ERS or USDA Economic Research Service numbers. However, it's not clear whether those numbers were gross income or actual take-home pay, and the two are entirely different. For instance, for every $100,000 in gross income that comes into the farm, there might be $15,000, I suppose, of income on the types of farm, grain farms, that she's been talking about. And those two numbers are really different. She wasn't clear about the fact. I wasn't clear about the fact, and we just couldn't come to a conclusion on it. You can read the Environmental Working Group's thoughts on this online at ewg.org. You can also talk about it next Tuesday at the Farm Assets Conference, if you'd like, in Normal, Illinois. Please get your tickets today, willag.org, farmassetsconference.com, or 800-898-1065. Well, let's check the cash grain side of the marketplace now. Matt Bennett is with us from Bennett Consulting Channel Seeds out of Windsor, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Matt, and thanks in advance for making time to come to the Farm Assets Conference and sitting on our corn panel in the afternoon. We appreciate that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to being there. I don't know the way the corn market's been acting. You might need to put some chicken wire up for us just in case they throw stuff at us. But try to make it at least informative and fun as what we can.
I can see you dressed as one of the Blues Brothers, and maybe we can have them throw stuff at you. Can you sing Rawhide?
Well, I can sing, but I'm not very good at it. So.
All right. So it's been kind of rough for the corn market, but there's an awful lot of corn around. So it's always price times bushels, and enough bushels are there that farmers should be able to make something of it. What are you telling them to do?
As I've talked all along this fall, I felt like we should be moving it right out of the field. I know that didn't help a guy that's sitting on a ton of corn sitting in the elevator right now, but they've kind of got to weigh their options at this point. Do they want to pay storage out past the first year? Obviously, storage is pretty much eating up the carry, even though we've got a full carry. And so, this is a tough environment to be in. This is definitely an environment where they have to crunch numbers. They've got to put their bushels and their price down on sheet of paper and see what they come up with. Now, some guys aren't coming up with a lot of black ink, but I want to pair that up with my soybean profit margins as well, because if nothing else, I want to at least lock in a worst-case scenario for the whole farm, because a lot of people made really good money on their soybeans again this year. And so if they can make money on the whole farm, that's the name of the game.
And then looking forward into next year, do you see any opportunities yet?
Well, I think the big opportunities I see on the cash side would be on basis, which has already started to creep a little bit better. I think if you continue in this type of futures market environment, basis is only going to stand to get better, which that means bin bushels that we've talked about selling the carry in all along. That's going to actually be a really good play. As far as selling new crop, we sold a ton of new crop above 395, and I still think there's a lot of producers that can sell even now if they take their five-year yield history, take today's price minus the basis. You can make really good money. Now, it's not like you're going to hit a home run, but at least locking in a worst-case scenario with a true hedge is probably not a bad play, because there's really no telling what will happen, because it sure seems like the path of least resistance on this corn market is lower.
Hey, looking forward to learning more from you next week on Tuesday at the Farm Assets Conference. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
That, of course, is Matt Bennett. He's with Bennett Consulting Channel Seeds out of Windsor, Illinois, and we'll be at the Farm Assets Conference next Tuesday. Hope you will be, too. This is the closing market report from Illinois Public Media. Buy those tickets for the Farm Assets Conference next Tuesday, just $35, willag.org, 800-898-1065. Mike Tenura is now here. He's with T-Storm out of Chicago. Hey, Mike, thanks for taking the time with us today. I'm glad you're on board with us.
Yeah, great to be here, Todd. I hope you're having a great day, too.
No, I am. Let's start in South America this week. Conditions in Brazil and Argentina.
Well, we're looking at Brazil fairly closely because we can tell that a wetter pattern is about to begin. We haven't seen too many problems in South America so far this growing season. And with the weather pattern that's coming up, there's not too much to be concerned about. A lot of rain is coming up for Brazil and Paraguay over the next 2 weeks, and that will lead to a situation in which we have abundant soil moisture by the beginning part of December. December is kind of when some of the key growing periods begin, though you could argue it might not be until mid-December. But nonetheless, over the next 2 weeks, a lot of rain for Brazil, and that includes all their corn and soybean areas. So no problems there. If you go a little bit further to the south into Argentina, it has been drying out a little bit over the last couple of weeks. It will stay fairly dry over the next week, after which a couple of thunderstorms pop up here and there. You could argue that you'd like to see a little more rain in Argentina, but soybean planting is only beginning at this moment, and most of the early planted corn still has a few more weeks before it really needs to worry about soil moisture. So all in all, the picture in South America is that we're in a waiting game. There's not a whole lot to be worried about right now, and there probably won't be much to think about until sometime in December at the very earliest.
Then, speaking of the winter months, I'm wondering if you've taken any time to search out some outlooks. Let's start with the cattle market and what that might look like for the winter, at least as it relates to the weather out west.
Well, the biggest clue we have for the winter regards the transition that is taking place right now to La Niña conditions. So we've had neutral conditions over the course of the summer and the fall, and now we're moving into a La Niña. That simply means that water temperatures out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean are a little bit cooler than normal. If you look at some of the years in the past where this happened, we can identify five similar transitions that have occurred since 1960. It doesn't really tell us a whole lot, though, about what to expect going forward. If you look at these key cattle areas of the plains, we've had some real wet winters when we have this type of transition take place. Two of the five analogs that we have were much wetter than normal. But the other 2 years were close to normal. That leaves 1 year left. That was near normal. So we do have to keep an eye on what's going to happen here coming up in December, January, and February for the cattle market. There have been some real wet winters out there in this type of transition, but it's not a solid case. We'd like to see all five of those years looking snowy or wet. We only have two that look real snowy or wet. Something to watch in a few weeks from now, but at the moment, not a whole lot to be excited about.
Does that mean anything for the winter wheat across the Great Plains?
Well, if you look at the wheat yields that followed this type of winter that we're expecting, we see a number of scenarios that have happened. We had three really good hard red winter wheat crops of those 5 years and two that were poor. So kind of an equal mix there, some good crops and some bad crops. So not a whole lot to latch on to, except to say that once we get into the spring, we might see some kind of clue at that point. For example, if it's real dry in the plains come March, then we might start to look at some of these dry analogs and say, well, this seems to be moving in that direction at this point in time. But again, there's just not much to talk about. If you look at corn and soybeans, though, it's a little bit easier to see. Of those five times in the past where we went from a neutral condition to a La Niña condition throughout the winter, the corn crops that followed were always near or above trend. So no bad crops followed this type of scenario. And for soybeans, we only had a bad crop once. That was in 1984 from a late season drought. So there's just not a whole lot happening right now, Todd. We will say this, you can look at these types of analogs and come to strong conclusions or weak conclusions or however you want to think about it. But in the end, we know that weather is random. So while these provide a nice outline and kind of a way we should view everything going forward, we don't want to just latch on and say, great corn crop coming, great soybean crop coming. This is not the way to do it. I know that's what the data says, but we only have five examples here in the last 55 years, so not a ton.
Hey, Mike, thanks so much, and thanks for the insight.
You're welcome, Todd. Have a great day.
You too. Mike Tenura is with T-Storm Weather out of Chicago. I'm Todd Gleason.